it had been. That bright room lay in ruins now. The very doors had been dragged from their hinges. Only the roof remained unscathed by the time the guilt-fouled fiend turned tail in despair of his life. But death is not easily escaped from by anyone. All of us with souls, earth-dwellers and children of men, must make our way to a destination already ordained, where the body, after the banqueting, sleeps on its deathbed. Then the due time arrived for Halfdane's son to proceed to the hall. The king himself would sit down to feast. No group ever gathered in greater numbers or better order around their ring-giver. The benches filled with famous men who fell to with relish. Round upon round of mead was passed. Those powerful kinsmen, Hrothgar and Hrothulf, were in high spirits in the raftered hall. Inside Heorot there was nothing but friendship. The shielding nation was not yet familiar with feud and betrayal. Then Halfdane's son presented Beowulf with a gold standard as a victory gift, an embroidered banner, also breastmail and a helmet, and a sword carried high that was both precious object and token of honor. So Beowulf drank his drink at ease. It was hardly a shame to be showered with such gifts in front of the hall troops. There haven't been many moments, I am sure, when men exchanged four such treasures at so friendly a sitting. An embossed ridge, a band lapped with wire arched over the helmet, head protection to keep the keen ground cutting edge from damaging it when danger threatened and the man was battling behind his shield. Next, the king ordered 8 horses with gold bridles to be brought through the yard into the hall. The harness of one included a saddle of sumptuous design, the battle seat where the son of Halfdane rode when he wished to join the sword play. Wherever the killing and carnage were the worst, he would be to the fore, fighting hard. Then the Danish prince, descendant of Ing, handed over both the arms and the horses, urging Beowulf to use them well. And so their leader, the lord and guard of coffer and strongroom, with customary grace, bestowed upon Beowulf both sets of gifts. A fair witness can see how well each one behaved. The chieftain went on to reward the others. Each man on the bench who had sailed with Beowulf and risked the voyage received a bounty, some treasured possession. And compensation, a price in gold, was settled for the Geat Grendel had cruelly killed earlier, as he would have killed more had not mindful God and one man's daring prevented that doom. Past and present, God's will prevails. Hence, understanding is always best, and a prudent mind. Whoever remains for long here in this earthly life will enjoy and endure more than enough. They sang then and played to please the hero. Words and music for their warrior prince, harp tunes and tales of adventure. There were high times on the hall benches, and the king's poet performed his part with the saga of Finn and his sons, unfolding the tale of the fierce attack in Friesland, where Hnaf, king of the Danes, met death. Hildeburh had little cause to credit the Jutes. Son and brother, she lost them both on the battlefield. She, bereft and blameless, they foredoomed, cut down and spear-gored. She, the woman in shock, waylaid by grief, Hoke's daughter, how could she not lament her fate when morning came and the light broke on her murdered dears? And so farewell, delight on earth. War carried away Finn's troop of thanes, all but a few. How then could Finn hold the line, or fight on to the end with Hengist? How save the rump of his force from that enemy chief? So a truce was offered as follows. First, separate quarters to be cleared for the Danes, hall and throne to be shared with the Frisians. Then, second, every day at the dole out of gifts, Finn, son of Folkwald, should honor the Danes, bestow with an even hand to Hengist and Hengist's men the wrought gold rings, bounty to match the measure he gave his own Frisians, to keep morale in the beer hall high. Both sides then sealed their agreement. With oaths to Hengist, Finn swore openly, solemnly, that the battle survivors would be guaranteed honor and status. No infringement by word or deed, no provocation would be permitted. Their own ring-giver, after all, was dead and gone. They were leaderless, enforced allegiance to his murderer. So if any Frisian stirred up bad blood with insinuations or taunts about this, the blade of the sword would arbitrate it. A funeral pyre was then prepared, effulgent gold brought out from the hoard. The pride and prince of the Shieldings lay awaiting the flame. Everywhere there were blood-plastered coats of mail. The pyre was heaped with boar-shaped helmets forged in gold. With the gashed corpses of well-born Danes, many had fallen. Then Hildeburh ordered her own son's body be burnt with hnafs, the flesh on his bones to sputter and blaze beside his uncle's. The woman wailed and sang keens. The warrior went up. Carcass flame swirled and fumed. They stood round the burial mound and howled as heads melted. Crusted gashes spattered and ran bloody matter. The glutton element flamed and consumed the dead of both sides. Their great days were gone. Warriors scattered to homes and forts all over Friesland. Fewer now, feeling loss of friends. Hengist stayed, lived out that whole resentful, blood-sullen winter with Finn, homesick and helpless. No ring-whorled prow could up then and away on the sea. Wind and water raged with storms, wave and shingle were shackled in ice until another year appeared in the yard, as it does to this day, the seasons constant, the wonder of light coming over us. Then winter was gone. Earth's lap grew lovely. Longing woke in the cooped-up exile for a voyage home. But more for vengeance. Some way of bringing things to a head. His sword arm hankered to greet the Jutes. So he did not balk once Hunlaving, placed on his lap, dazzle the duel. The best sword of all, whose edges Jutes knew only too well. Thus blood was spilled, the gallant Finn slain in his home, after Guthlaf and Oslaf, back from their voyage, made old accusation. The brutal ambush, the fate they had suffered, all blamed on Finn. The wildness in them had to brim over. The hall ran red with blood of enemies. Finn was cut down, the queen brought away, and everything the Shieldings could find inside Finn's walls, the Frisian king's gold collars and gemstones, swept off to the ship. Over sea lanes, then back to Daneland, the warrior troop bore that lady home. The poem was over. The poet had performed. A pleasant murmur started on the benches. Stewards did the rounds with wine and splendid jugs. And Walchtheow came to sit in her gold crown between two good men, uncle and nephew, each one of whom still trusted the other. And the forthright Unverth admired by all for his mind and courage, although under a cloud for killing his brothers, reclined near the king. The queen spoke. "Enjoy this drink, my most generous lord. Raise up your goblet, entertain the Geats duly and gently, discourse with them, be open-handed, happy and fond. Relish their company, but recollect as well all of the boons that have been bestowed on you. The bright court of Herat has been cleansed, and now the word is that you want to adopt this warrior as a son. So, while you may, bask in your fortune, and then bequeath kingdom and nation to your kith and kin before your decease. I am certain of Hrothulf. He is noble and will use the young ones well. He will not let you down. Should you die before him, he will treat our children truly and fairly. He will honor, I am sure, our two sons, repay them in kind when he recollects all the good things we gave him once, the favor and respect he found in his childhood." She turned then to the bench where her boys sat, Hraedhric and Hrothmund, with other noble sons, all the youth together. And that good man, Beowulf the Geat, sat between the brothers. The cup was carried to him, kind words spoken in welcome, and a wealth of wrought gold graciously bestowed. Two arm bangles, a mail shirt and rings, and the most resplendent torque of gold I ever heard tell of, anywhere on earth or under heaven. There was no hoard like it, since Hama snatched the Brosing's neck-chain and bore it away, with its gems and settings, to his shining fort, away from Ermenric's wiles and hatred, and thereby ensured his eternal reward. Hujolak the Geat, grandson of Sverting, wore this neck-ring on his last raid. At bay, under his banner, he defended the booty, treasure he had won. Fate swept him away because of his proud need to provoke a feud with the Frisians. He fell beneath his shield in the same gem-crusted, kingly gear he had worn when he crossed the frothing wave-vat. So the dead king fell into Frankish hands. They took his breast-mail, also his neck-torque, and punier warriors plundered the slain when the carnage ended. Geat corpses covered the field. Applause filled the hall. Then Waltheow pronounced in the presence of the company, "Take delight in this talk, dear Beowulf. Wear it for luck, and wear also this mail from our people's armory. May you prosper in them. Be acclaimed for strength, for kindly guidance to these two boys, and your bounty will be sure. You have won renown. You are known to all men far and near, now and forever. Your sway is wide as the wind's home, as the sea around cliffs. And so, my prince, I wish you a lifetime's luck and blessings to enjoy this treasure. Treat my sons with tender care. Be strong and kind. Here each comrade is true to the other, loyal to lord, loving in spirit. The thanes have one purpose, the people are ready. Having drunk and pledged, the ranks do as I bid." She moved then to her place. Men were drinking wine at that rare feast. How could they know fate, the grim shape of things to come, the threat looming over many thanes as night approached, and King Hrothgar prepared to retire to his quarters? Retainers in great numbers were posted on guard, as so often in the past. Benches were pushed back, bedding gear and bolsters spread across the floor, and one man lay down to his rest, already marked for death. At their heads they placed their polished timber battle shields, and on the bench above them each man's kit was kept to hand, a towering war helmet, webbed mail shirt, and great shafted spear. It was their habit always and everywhere to be ready for action, at home or in the camp, in whatever case and at whatever time the need arose, to rally round their Lord. They were a right people. They went to sleep. And one paid dearly for his night's ease, as had happened to them often, ever since Grendel occupied the Gold Hall, committing evil until the end came, death after his crimes. Then it became clear, obvious to everyone once the fight was over, that an Avenger lurked and was still alive, grimly biding time. Grendel's mother, monstrous hell bride, brooded on her wrongs. She had been forced down into fearful waters, the cold depths, after Cain had killed his father's son, felled his own brother with a sword. Branded an outlaw, marked by having murdered, he moved into the wilds, shunned company and joy. And from Cain there sprang misbegotten spirits, among them Grendel, the banished and accursed, due to come to grips with that watcher in Heorot, waiting to do battle. The monster wrenched and wrestled with him, but Beowulf was mindful of his mighty strength, the wondrous gifts God had showered on him. He relied for help on the Lord of all, on his care and favor. So he overcame the foe, brought down the hell brute. Broken and bowed, outcast from all sweetness, the enemy of mankind made for his death-den. But now his mother had sallied forth on a savage journey, grief-racked and ravenous, desperate for revenge. She came to Heorot. There, inside the hall, Danes lay asleep. Earls who would soon endure a great reversal, once Grendel's mother attacked and entered. Her onslaught was less only by as much as an Amazon warrior's strength is less than an armed man's when the hefted sword, its hammered edge and gleaming blade slathered in blood, raises the sturdy boar ridge off a helmet. Then in the hall, hard-honed swords were grabbed from the bench, many a broad shield lifted and braced. There was little thought of helmets or woven mail when they woke in terror. The hell dam was in panic, desperate to get out, in mortal terror the moment she was found. She had pounced and taken one of the retainers in a tight hold, then headed for the fen. To Hrothgar, this man was the most beloved of the friends he trusted between the two seas. She had done away with a great warrior, ambushed him at rest. Beowulf was elsewhere. Earlier, after the award of the treasure, the Geat had been given another lodging. There was uproar in Heorot. She had snatched their trophy, Grendel's bloodied hand. It was a fresh blow to the afflicted Bonn. The bargain was hard, both parties having to pay with the lives of friends. And the old lord, the gray-haired warrior, was heart-sore and weary when he heard the news. His highest-placed adviser, his dearest companion, was dead and gone. Beowulf was quickly brought to the chamber. The winner of fights, the arch-warrior, came first-footing in with his fellow troops to where the king in his wisdom waited, still wondering whether Almighty God would ever turn the tide of his misfortunes. So Beowulf entered with his band in attendance, and the wooden floorboards banged and rang as he advanced, hurrying to address the prince of the Ingwins, asking if he'd rested, since the urgent summons had come as a surprise. Then Hrothgar, the shielding's helmet, spoke. "Rest! What is rest? Sorrow has returned. Alas for the Danes! Asherah is dead. He was Ermenlaf's elder brother, and a soul-mate to me, a true mentor, my right-hand man when the ranks clashed and our boar-crests had to take a battering in the line of action. Asherah was everything the world admires in a wise man and a friend. Then this roaming killer came in a fury and slaughtered him in Heorot, where she is hiding, glutting on the corpse and glorying in her escape, I cannot tell. She has taken up the feud because of last night, when you killed Grendel, wrestled and racked him in ruinous combat, since for too long he had terrorized us with his depredations. He died in battle, paid with his life, and now this powerful other one arrives, this force for evil, driven to avenge her kinsman's death. Or so it seems to thanes in their grief, in the anguish every thane endures at the loss of a ring-giver, now that the hand that bestowed so richly has been stilled in death. I have heard it said by my people in Hall, counsellors who live in the upland country, that they have seen two such creatures prowling the moors, huge marauders from some other world. One of these things, as far as anyone ever can discern, looks like a woman. The other, warped in the shape of a man, moves beyond the pale, bigger than any man, an unnatural birth called Grendel by country people in former days. They are fatherless creatures, and their whole ancestry is hidden in a past of demons and ghosts. They dwell apart among wolves on the hills, on wind-swept crags and treacherous caches, where cold streams pour down the mountain and disappear under mist and moorland. A few miles from here, a frost-stiffened wood waits and keeps watch above a mere. The overhanging bank is a maze of tree roots mirrored in its surface. At night there, something uncanny happens. The water burns. And the mere bottom has never been sounded by the sons of men. On its bank, the heather stepper halts. The hart, in flight from pursuing hounds, will turn to face them with firm-set horns and die in the wood rather than dive beneath its surface. That is no good place. When wind blows up and stormy weather makes clouds scud and the skies weep, out of its depths a dirty surge is pitched towards the heavens. Now help depends again on you, and on you alone. The gap of danger where the demon waits is still unknown to you. Seek it if you dare. I will compensate you for settling the feud as I did the last time, with lavish wealth, coffers of coiled gold, if you come back. Beowulf, son of Edgetheow, spoke.
Why, sir, do not grieve. It is always better to avenge dear ones than to indulge in mourning. For every one of us, living in this world means waiting for our end. Let whoever can win glory before death. When a warrior is gone, that will be his best and only bulwark. So arise, my lord, and let us immediately set forth on the trail of this troll dam. I guarantee you she will not get away, not to dens underground, nor upland groves, nor the ocean floor. She'll have nowhere to flee to. Endure your troubles today, bear up, and be the man I expect you to be.
With that, the old lord sprang to his feet and praised God for Beowulf's pledge. Then a bit and halter were brought for his horse with the plaited mane. The wise king mounted the royal saddle and rode out in style with a force of shield-bearers. The forest paths were marked all over with the monster's tracks. Her trail on the ground wherever she had gone across the dark moors, dragging away the body of that thane, Hrothgar's best counselor and overseer of the country. So the noble prince proceeded, undismayed, up fells and screes, along narrow footpaths and ways where they were forced into single file, ledges on cliffs above lairs of water monsters. He went in front with a few men, good judges of the lie of the land, and suddenly discovered the dismal wood, mountain trees growing out at an angle above grey stones. The bloodshot water surged underneath. It was a sore blow to all of the Danes, friends of the Scyldings, a hurt to each and every one of that noble company, when they came upon Asherah's head at the foot of the cliff. Everybody gazed as the hot gore kept wallowing up, and an urgent war horn repeated its notes. The whole party sat down to watch. The water was infested with all kinds of reptiles. There were writhing sea dragons and monsters slouching on slopes by the cliff, serpents and wild things such as those that often surface at dawn to roam the sail road and doom the voyage. Down they plunged, lashing in anger at the loud call of the battle bugle. An arrow from the bow of the Geat chief got one of them as he surged to the surface. The seasoned shaft stuck deep in his flank, and his freedom in the water got less and less. It was his last swim. He was swiftly overwhelmed in the shallows, prodded by barbed boar spears, cornered, beaten, pulled up on the bank, a strange lake birth, a loathsome catch, men gazed at in awe. Beowulf got ready, donned his war gear, indifferent to death. His mighty, hand-forged, fine-webbed mail would soon meet with the menace underwater. It would keep the bone cage of his body safe. No enemy's clasp could crush him in it. No vicious armlock choke his life out. To guard his head, he had a glittering helmet that was due to be muddied on the mere bottom and blurred in the upswirl. It was of beaten gold, princely headgear, hooped and hasped by a weaponsmith who had worked wonders in days gone by and adorned it with boar shapes. Since then, it had resisted every sword. And another item lent by Unverf at that moment of need was of no small importance. The Brehon handed him a hilted weapon, a rare and ancient sword named Hrunting. The iron blade, with its ill-boding patterns, had been tempered in blood. It had never failed the hand of anyone who hefted it in battle, anyone who had fought and faced the worst in the gap of danger. This was not the first time it had been called to perform heroic feats. When he lent that blade to the better swordsman, Unverf, the strong-built son of Egelaf, could hardly have remembered the ranting speech he had made in his cups. He was not man enough to face the turmoil of a fight underwater and the risk to his life. So there he lost fame and repute. It was different for the other, rigged out in his gear, ready to do battle. Beowulf, son of Egtheow, spoke. "Wisest of kings, now that I have come to the point of action, I ask you to recall what we said earlier, that you, son of Halfdane, and gold friend to retainers, that you, if I should fall and suffer death while serving your cause, would act like a father to me afterwards. If this combat kills me, take care of my young company, my comrades in arms. And be sure also, my beloved Hrothgar, to send Hujalak the treasures I received. Let the lord of the Geats gaze on that gold. Let Hrethel's son take note of it and see that I found a ring-giver of rare magnificence and enjoyed the good of his generosity. And Unverf is to have what I inherited. To that far-famed man I bequeath my own sharp-honed, wave-sheened wonder-blade. With Hrunting I shall gain glory or die." After these words, the prince of the Weather Geats was impatient to be away, and plunged suddenly. Without more ado, he dived into the heaving depths of the lake.
It was the best part of a day before he could see the solid bottom. Quickly, the one who haunted those waters, who had scavenged and gone her gluttonous rounds for 100 seasons, sensed a human observing her outlandish lair from above. So she lunged and clutched and managed to catch him in her brutal grip. But his body, for all that, remained unscathed. The mesh of the chainmail saved him on the outside. Her savage talons failed to rip the web of his war shirt. Then, once she touched bottom, that wolfish swimmer carried the ring-mailed prince to her court so that for all his courage he could never use the weapons he carried. And a bewildering horde came at him from the depths, droves of sea-beasts who attacked with tusks and tore at his chain-mail in a ghastly onslaught. The gallant man could see he had entered some hellish turnhole, and yet the water did not work against him, because the hall roofing held off the force of the current. Then he saw firelight, a gleam and flare-up, a glimmer of brightness. The hero observed that swamp thing from hell, the tarn hag in all her terrible strength, then heaved his war sword and swung his arm. The decorated blade came down ringing and singing on her head, but he soon found his battle torch extinguished. The shining blade refused to bite. It spared her and failed the man in his need. It had gone through many hand-to-hand fights, had hewed the armor and helmets of the doomed, but here at last the fabulous powers of that heirloom failed. Huyalak's kinsman kept thinking about his name and fame. He never lost heart. Then, in a fury, he flung his sword away. The keen, inlaid, worm-loop-patterned steel was hurled to the ground. He would have to rely on the might of his arm. So must a man do who intends to gain enduring glory in a combat. Life doesn't cost him a thought. Then the Prince of Wargaetz, warming to this fight with Grendel's mother, gripped her shoulder and laid about him in a battle frenzy. He pitched his killer opponent to the floor, but she rose quickly and retaliated, grappled him tightly in her grim embrace. The sure-footed fighter felt daunted. The strongest of warriors stumbled and fell. So she pounced upon him and pulled out a broad, whetted knife. Now she would avenge her only child. But the mesh of chain-mail on Beowulf's shoulder shielded his life, turned the edge and tip of the blade. The son of Edgetheow would have surely perished, and the Geats lost their warrior under the wide earth, had the strong links and locks of his war-gear not helped to save him. Holy God decided the victory. It was easy for the Lord, the ruler of heaven, to redress the balance once Beowulf got back up on his feet. Then he saw a blade that boded well, a sword in her armory, an ancient heirloom from the days of the giants, an ideal weapon, one that any warrior would envy, but so huge and heavy of itself, only Beowulf could wield it in a battle. So the shielding's hero, hard-pressed and enraged, took a firm hold of the hilt and swung the blade in an arc, a resolute blow that bit deep into her neck-bone and severed it entirely, toppling the doomed house of her flesh. She fell to the floor. The sword dripped blood. The swordsman was elated. A light appeared, and the place brightened the way the sky does when heaven's candle is shining clearly. He inspected the vault, with sword held high, its hilt raised to guard and threaten, Huyalak's thane scouted by the wall in Grendel's wake. Now the weapon was to prove its worth. The warrior determined to take revenge for every gross act Grendel had committed. And not only for that one occasion when he'd come to slaughter the sleeping troops, 15 of Hrothgar's house guards surprised on their benches and ruthlessly devoured, and as many again carried away a brutal plunder. Beowulf, in his fury,
now settled that score. He saw the monster in his resting place, war-weary and wrecked, a lifeless corpse, a casualty of the battle in Herat. The body gaped at the stroke dealt to it after death. Beowulf cut the corpse's head off. Immediately the counselors keeping a lookout with Hrothgar, watching the lake water, saw a heave-up and surge of waves and blood in the backwash. They bowed gray heads, spoke in their sage, experienced way about the good warrior, how they never again expected to see that prince returning in triumph to their king. It was clear to many that the wolf of the deep had destroyed him forever. The ninth hour of the day arrived. The brave shieldings abandoned the cliff-top, and the king went home. But sick at heart, staring at the mere, the strangers held on. They wished, without hope, to behold their lord Beowulf himself. Meanwhile, the sword began to wilt into gory icicles, to slather and thaw. It was a wonderful thing, the way it all melted as ice melts when the father eases the fetters off the frost and unravels the water ropes. He who wields power over time and tide, he is the true lord. The Geat captain saw treasure in abundance, but carried no spoils from those quarters, except for the head and the inlaid hilt embossed with jewels. Its blade had melted, and the scrollwork on it burnt, so scalding was the blood of the poisonous fiend who had perished there. Then away he swam, the one who had survived the fall of his enemies, flailing to the surface. The wide water, the waves and pools were no longer infested once the wandering fiend let go of her life and this unreliable world. The seafarer's leader made for land, resolutely swimming, delighted with his prize, the mighty load he was lugging to the surface. His thanes advanced in a troop to meet him, thanking God and taking great delight in seeing their prince back safe and sound. Quickly the hero's helmet and mail shirt were loosed and unlaced. The lake settled, clouds darkened above the bloodshot depths. With high hearts they headed away, along footpaths and trails through the fields, roads that they knew, each of them wrestling with the head they were carrying from the lakeside cliff, men kingly in their courage and capable of difficult work. It was a task for four to hoist Grendel's head on a spear and bear it under strain to the bright hall. But soon enough they neared the place, 14 Geats in fine fettle, striding across the outlying ground in a delighted throng around their leader. In he came, then, the Thane's commander, the arch-warrior, to address Hrothgar. His courage was proven, his glory was secure. Grendel's head was hauled by the hair, dragged across the floor where the people were drinking, a horror for both queen and company to behold. They stared in awe. It was an astonishing sight. Beowulf, son of Edgetheow, spoke. "So, son of Halfdane, prince of the Shieldings, we are glad to bring this booty from the lake. It is a token of triumph, and we tender it to you. I barely survived the battle underwater. It was hard-fought, a desperate affair that could have gone badly. If God had not helped me, the outcome would have been quick and fatal. Although Hrunting is hard-edged, I could never bring it to bear in battle. But the Lord of Men allowed me to behold, for he often helps the unbefriended, an ancient sword shining on the wall, a weapon made for giants, there for the wielding. Then my moment came in the combat, and I struck the dwellers in that den. Next thing, the damascened sword blade melted. It bloated, and it burned in their rushing blood. I have wrested the hilt from the enemy's hand, avenged the evil done to the Danes. It is what was due.
and this I pledge, O Prince of the Scyldings. You can sleep secure with your company of troops in Heret Hall. Never need you fear for a single thane of your sept or nation, young warriors or old, that laying waste of life that you and your people endured of yore. Then the gold hilt was handed over to the old lord, a relic from long ago for the venerable ruler. That rare smithwork was passed on to the Prince of the Danes when those devils perished. Once death removed that murdering, guilt-steeped, God-cursed fiend, eliminating his unholy life and his mother's as well, it was willed to that king, who of all the lavish gift-lords of the north was the best regarded between the two seas. Hrothgar spoke. He examined the hilt, that relic of old times. It was engraved all over and showed how war first came into the world, and the flood destroyed the tribe of giants. They suffered a terrible severance from the Lord. The Almighty made the waters rise, drowned them in the deluge for retribution. In pure gold inlay on the sword guards, there were rune markings correctly incised, stating and recording for whom the sword had been first made and ornamented with its scroll-worked hilt. Then everyone hushed, as the son of Halfdane spoke this wisdom. A protector of his people, pledged to uphold truth and justice, and to respect tradition, is entitled to affirm that this man was born to distinction. Beowulf, my friend, your fame has gone far and wide. You are known everywhere. In all things you are even-tempered, prudent and resolute. So I stand firm by the promise of friendship we exchanged before. Forever you will be your people's mainstay and your own warrior's helping hand. Heremod was different, the way he behaved to Edgewalla's sons. His rise in the world brought little joy to the Danish people, only death and destruction. He vented his rage on men he caroused with, killed his own comrades, a pariah king who cut himself off from his own kind, even though Almighty God had made him eminent and powerful, and marked him from the start for a happy life. But a change happened. He grew bloodthirsty, gave no more rings to honor the Danes. He suffered in the end for having plagued his people for so long. His life lost happiness. So, learn from this and understand true values. I, who tell you, have wintered into wisdom. It is a great wonder how Almighty God, in his magnificence, favors our race with rank and scope and the gift of wisdom. His sway is wide. Sometimes he allows the mind of a man of distinguished birth to follow its bent, grants him fulfillment and felicity on earth, and forts to command in his own country. He permits him to lord it in many lands, until the man in his unthinkingness forgets that it will ever end for him. He indulges his desires. Illness and old age mean nothing to him. His mind is untroubled by envy or malice, or the thought of enemies with their hate-honed swords. The whole world conforms to his will. He is kept from the worst until an element of overweening enters him and takes hold, while the soul's guard, its sentry, drowses, grown too distracted. A killer stalks him, an archer who draws a deadly bow. And then the man is hit in the heart, the arrow flies beneath his defenses, the devious promptings of the demon start. His old possessions seem paltry to him now. He covets and resents, dishonors custom and bestows no gold. and because of good things that the heavenly powers gave him in the past, he ignores the shape of things to come. Then, finally, the end arrives, when the body he was lent collapses and falls prey to its death. Ancestral possessions and the goods he hoarded are inherited by another, who lets them go with a liberal hand. O flower of warriors, beware of that trap. Choose, dear Beowulf, the better part, eternal rewards. Do not give way to pride. For a brief while, your strength is in bloom, but it fades quickly, and soon they will follow illness or the sword to lay you low, or a sudden fire or surge of water or jabbing blade or javelin from the air, or repellent age. Your piercing eye will dim and darken, and death will arrive, dear warrior, to sweep you away. Just so I ruled the Ring-Dane's country for 50 years, defended them in wartime with spear and sword against constant assaults by many tribes. I came to believe my enemies had faded from the face of the earth. Still, what happened was a hard reversal from bliss to grief. Grendel struck after lying in wait. He laid waste to the land, and from that moment my mind was in dread of his depredations. So I praise God in his heavenly glory, that I lived to behold this head dripping blood, and that after such harrowing I can look upon it in triumph at last. Take your place, then, with pride and pleasure, and move to the feast. Tomorrow morning our treasure will be shared and showered upon you. The Geat was elated, and gladly obeyed the old man's bidding. He sat on the bench, and soon all was restored, the same as before. Happiness came back, the hall was thronged, and a banquet set forth. Black night fell and covered them in darkness. Then the company rose for the old campaigner. The gray-haired prince was ready for bed, and a need for rest came over the brave, shield-bearing Geat. He was a weary seafarer, far from home. So immediately a house guard guided him out, one whose office entailed looking after whatever a thane on the road in those days might need or require. It was noble courtesy. That great heart rested. The hall towered, gold-shingled and gabled, and the guest slept in it, until the black raven with raucous glee announced heaven's joy, and a hurry of brightness overran the shadows. Warriors rose quickly, impatient to be off. Their own country was beckoning the nobles, and the bold voyager longed to be aboard his distant boat. Then that stalwart fighter ordered Hunting to be brought to Unverth, and bade Unverth take the sword, and thanked him for lending it. He said he had found it a friend in battle, and a powerful help. He put no blame on the blade's cutting edge. He was a considerate man. And there the warriors stood in their war gear, eager to go, while their honored lord approached the platform where the other sat. The undaunted hero addressed Hrothgar. Beowulf, son of Egtheow, spoke. "Now we who crossed the wide sea have to inform you that we feel a desire to return to Hyalak. Here we have been welcomed and thoroughly entertained. You have treated us well. If there is any favour on earth I can perform beyond deeds of arms I have done already, anything that would merit your affections more, I shall act, my lord, with alacrity. If ever I hear from across the ocean that people on your borders are threatening battle, as attackers have done from time to time, I shall land with 1,000 thanes at my back to help your cause. Huyalak may be young to rule a nation, but this much I know about the king of the Geats. He will come to my aid and want to support me by word and action in your hour of need, when honor dictates that I raise a hedge of spears around you. Then, if Raetherick should think about traveling as a king's son to the court of the Geats, he will find many friends. Foreign places yield more to one who is himself worth meeting. Hrothgar spoke and answered him. The Lord in his wisdom sent you those words, and they came from the heart. I have never heard so young a man make truer observations. You are strong in body and mature in mind, impressive in speech. If it should come to pass that Hrethel's descendant dies beneath a spear, if deadly battle or the sword blade or disease fells the prince who guards your people and you are still alive, then I firmly believe the seafaring Geats won't find a man worthier of acclaim as their king and defender than you, if only you would undertake the lordship of your homeland. My liking for you deepens with time, dear Beowulf. What you have done is to draw two peoples, the Geat nation and us, neighboring Danes, into shared peace and a pact of friendship in spite of hatreds we have harbored in the past. For as long as I rule this far-flung land, treasures will change hands and each side will treat the other with gifts. Across the Gannet's Bath, over the broad sea, world prows will bring presents and tokens. I know your people are beyond reproach in every respect, steadfast in the old way with friend or foe. Then the Earl's defender furnished the hero with 12 treasures and told him to set out, sail with those gifts safely home to the people he loved, but to return promptly. And so the good and gray-haired Dane, that high-born king, kissed Beowulf and embraced his neck, then broke down in sudden tears. 2 forebodings disturbed him in his wisdom, but one was stronger. Nevermore would they meet each other face to face. And such was his affection that he could not help being overcome. His fondness for the man was so deep-founded, it warmed his heart and wound the heartstrings tight in his breast. The embrace ended, and Beowulf, glorious in his gold regalia, stepped the green earth. Straining at anchor and ready for boarding, his boat awaited him. So they went on their journey, and Hrothgar's generosity was praised repeatedly. He was a peerless king, until old age sapped his strength and did him mortal harm, as it has done so many. Down to the waves, then, dressed in the web of their chainmail and war shirts, the young men marched in high spirits. The coast guard spied them, thanes setting forth, the same as before. His salute this time from the top of the cliff was far from unmannerly. He galloped to meet them, and as they took ship in their shining gear, he said how welcome they would be in Geatland. Then the broad hull was beached on the sand to be cargoed with treasure, horses and war gear. The curved prow motioned. The mast stood high above Hrothgar's riches in the loaded hold. The guard who had watched the boat was given a sword with gold fittings, and in future days that present would make him a respected man at his place on the mead bench. Then the keel plunged and shook in the sea, and they sailed from Denmark. Right away the mast was rigged with its seashell. Sail ropes were tightened, timbers drummed, and stiff winds kept the wave-crosser skimming ahead. As she heaved forward, her foamy neck was fleet and buoyant, a lapped prow loping over currents, until finally the Gayats caught sight of coastline and familiar cliffs. The keel reared up, wind lifted it home, it hit on the land. The harbor guard came hurrying out to the rolling water. He had watched the offing long and hard, on the lookout for those friends. With the anchor cables, he moored their craft right where it had beached, in case a backwash might catch the hull and carry it away. Then he ordered the prince's treasure trove to be carried ashore. It was a short step from there to where Hrethel's son and heir, Hugalak, the gold-giver, makes his home on a secure cliff, in the company of retainers. The building was magnificent, the king majestic, ensconced in his hall. And although Hyd, his queen, was young, a few short years at court, her mind was thoughtful and her manners sure. Haereth's daughter behaved generously and stinted nothing when she distributed bounty to the Geats. Great Queen Modrith perpetrated terrible wrongs. If any retainer ever made bold to look in her face, if an eye, not her lord's, stared at her directly during daylight, the outcome was sealed. He was kept bound in hand-tightened shackles, racked, tortured until doom was pronounced, death by the sword, slash of blade, blood gush and death qualms in an evil display. Even a queen, outstanding in beauty, must not overstep like that. A queen should weave peace, not punish the innocent with loss of life or imagined insults. But Hemming's kinsmen put a halt to her ways, and drinkers round the table had another tale. She was less of a bane to people's lives, less cruel-minded, after she was married to the brave Offa. A bride arrayed in her gold finery, given away by a caring father, ferried to her young prince over dim seas. In days to come, she would grace the throne and grow famous for her good deeds and conduct of life. Her high devotion to the hero king, who was the best king, it has been said, between the two seas or anywhere else on the face of the earth. Offa was honored far and wide for his generous ways, his fighting spirit, and his far-seeing defense of his homeland. From him there sprang Eomer, Garmon's grandson, kinsman of Hemming, his warrior's mainstay and master of the field. Heroic Beowulf and his band of men crossed the wide strand, striding along the sandy foreshore. The sun shone, the world's candle warmed them from the south, as they hastened to where, as they had heard, the young king, Ongandeo's killer and his people's protector, was dispensing rings inside his barn. Beowulf's return was reported to Hugalak as soon as possible. News that the captain was now in the enclosure, his battle brother, back from the fray, alive and well, walking to the hall. Room was quickly made on the king's orders, and the troops filed across the cleared floor. After Hugalak had offered greetings to his loyal thane in lofty speech, he and his kinsmen, that hale survivor, sat face to face. Haereth's daughter moved about with the mead jug in her hand, taking care of the company, filling the cups that warriors held out. Then Hugalak began to put courteous questions to his old comrade in the high hall. He hankered to know every tale the Sea Geats had to tell. "How did you fare on your foreign voyage, dear Beowulf, when you abruptly decided to sail away across the salt water and fight at Heorot? Did you help Hrothgar much in the end? Could you ease the prince of his well-known troubles? Your undertaking cast my spirits down. I dreaded the outcome of your expedition, and pleaded with you long and hard to leave the Killer Bee. Let the South Danes settle their own blood feud with Grendel. So God be thanked I am granted this sight of you, safe and sound. Beowulf, son of Egtheow, spoke.
"What happened, Lord Hujalak? He's hardly